I had no idea what was going on. I'm like, why is your pregnancy test positive? She's like, not only am I 61, but I also haven't had sex in 5 years. So there is absolutely no way that there is any fertilization going on.
Welcome to Dr. Brian Boxer Walkler's Health Show. Each week, Dr. Brian will pull the curtain back on viral TikTok health videos and label them as cap, false, or no cap, true. Even if you aren't on TikTok, now is the time to get on board, have fun, and join his podcast. Dr. Brian is a board-certified eye surgeon specializing in advanced LASIK, keratoconus, wider eyes, dry eyes, cataract surgery, and reading vision improvement at the Boxer Walkler Vision Institute in Beverly Hills, California. Also, please remember, Dr. Brian is a doctor, but he is not your doctor. He is here to provide general information, not medical advice, so you should always check with your doctor before relying on any information.
Hey, welcome back to Dr. Brian's Health Show. If you've noticed, we've renamed it to make it a little more clear for everybody what the show is about. And so this week, instead of doing a video commentary, I decided to ask a friend of mine, Dr. Fayez Ajib. You know him as Life of a Doctor on social media. He's an ER physician, and he has so many amazing stories. So I wanted to talk with him about some of these really memorable stories. And there's going to be a lot we're going to talk about, but one of them in today's episode is going to be about a pregnant 60-year-old woman, question mark. And before we get started, just to remind you all that my book is coming out really soon about social media, and it's basically like pro tips for social media. So if you want to really understand social media, you want to even grow your platform, do grab that book. It's called Influenced, and it's on Amazon. The link is actually in the show notes, and it's really amazing. And actually, I had interviewed Dr. Fayez for the book as well, among about 14 other influencers who contributed. And it's just a wealth of information. You're not going to find any of the insights and tips, the pro tips. You won't find any of those pro tips anywhere else. And do get that right now. So now, Dr. Fayez, I'm so excited to have you here because we've been friends through TikTok originally from really the very beginning when I first started, when I was in diapers on social media. So it's really fun to have you back. And let's just dive right into this. So we're going to talk about some really cool stories from the ER. And now you're here back in Southern California, which is exciting with your family. So even from back in Miami, let's just start off. Like, what are some of the really indelible stories, experiences you had in the ER that you just probably will never forget?
So that's, I mean, yeah, it's crazy to think about how, you know, I just, you know, just started my career in emergency medicine, but I feel like I already have enough stories and experiences that will last me kind of like a lifetime, even though my career is just beginning. But especially training in Miami, you get kind of the craziest like presentations and the cases. The pathology there is also, you know, really diverse. So you get to see really everything from the non-so emergencies to kind of like the worst traumas that we've had. Because I also worked at a trauma center. So the breadth of, you know, knowledge that you kind of gain over those experiences was insane.
Well, I just think, you know, people are always interested in ER. I mean, those emergency shows, right, have been going on for like 50 years on TV. So everybody's always fascinated with what people are seeing in the ER. And so if people are just going to be a fly on the wall, let's just start with a story of a patient. Of course, no names for patient privacy, but what they came in with, what almost sort of blew you away.
One of my favorite stories to tell was when I was at Tampa General, which is a level one trauma center. So they see a ton of traumas that come in. And one time we had this 17-year-old kid that came into the ER after a stabbing. So he walked in and he didn't walk in by EMS or anything like that. He just walked into the ER and he said, "My girlfriend stabbed me." So, yeah. So we kind of bring him to the back.
Hopefully still not the girlfriend anymore. Oh, it was a loving stabbing on Valentine's Day.
He was a 17-year-old kid, comes into the ER, said, I got stabbed by my girlfriend and I want to get checked out. So we're like, okay, you know, he's walking, he's talking, he doesn't seem to be in any significant distress, right? Like he's not like bleeding from anywhere that we could see or anything like that. So we walk him to one of the back rooms and we kind of just tell him just to get undressed, just to kind of look where the stabbings was. And takes off his shirt and pretty much all across the right side of his back, he had all these stab wounds. So this is where it gets interesting, right? Because in the ER, you see a lot of stab wounds. It's quite common, you know.
After you say he's got all these stab wounds on his back, but then this is now where it gets interesting, as if that was like very, oh yeah, that's just like bread and butter stuff we see all the time. So I can't wait to hear what you're.
Yeah, you know, you get stabbed here and there, but this one, you know, this one was sticks out to memory for sure. You know, we stabilize him, you know, get him on the monitors, we get his oxygen. Oxygen's beautiful, it's at 100%. You know, his blood pressure is fine. His heart rate is a little high, but nothing too crazy. So, you know, then I put him in for an x-ray order because that's kind of one of the first things that we do is just to look at, just like a plain radiograph to kind of evaluate the extent of injuries. While, you know, x-ray is making its way over, I started talking to him. I'm like, so what happened? How'd you get stabbed? And he was telling me that he was with his girlfriend. And him and his girlfriend were just kind of like hanging out, you know, in the kitchen or whatever. And he grabbed her phone. So this is something that you probably shouldn't do, is grab somebody else's phone and start looking into it. So I guess he was suspected that she was like cheating on him or something like that. And so he grabs her phone and he starts going through it. And she immediately just, you know, blows up on him and tries taking the phone away, but he wouldn't like let her. So he kind of like turns around and like into like almost like a corner. So he's like able to still look at, you know, his phone while, you know, his back is turned towards her. So she does what, you know, the only logical thing to do in that situation, being in the kitchen,
of course,
is grab a kitchen knife and start stabbing him in the back. She stabbed him a total of 7 times before he handed over the phone.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I was like, wow, that sounds pretty intense. He's like, yeah, you know, we're just, you know, we're really in love and, you know, there's just a lot of emotions in the air.
So, oh my gosh. Wow.
So then I started like questioning my own, like, you know, relationships. I'm like, damn, like, you know, I know she loves me, but does she like stab me, love me, you know?
The true test of love is reaching in and pulling out a nicely sharpened steak
exactly.
knife and going at it on your significant other. Right. There's other ways to prove and show your affection.
So we get the x-ray and, you know, we quick do like a bedside x-ray. Really, the x-rays are just to like look at the lungs, right? One of the biggest things that we worry about with any sort of like penetrating trauma to the thorax, like the chest or the back, especially if it's above the diaphragm, of course, is like lung injury. So, you know, when you get stabbed multiple times, you can actually develop something called like a pneumothorax, which essentially is a collapsed lung. So he had complete collapse of the left lung, which absolutely blew my mind because, you know, how are you, you know, how's your oxygen 100%? How are you not tachypneic, like breathing heavily? How, you know, your heart rate's a little high, but other than that, everything seemed good. It's crazy, especially with these younger patients. I've actually had this situation happen twice, another story. I told him, I'm like, hey, like, you know, like half your lung is collapsed. And we do something called a chest tube. But for like this type of, you know, scenario where it's just a pneumothorax, so it's not like there's any blood in there or anything. So we traditionally don't use the large chest tubes. We use kind of like the pigtail sized chest tubes. It's like much less painful for the patient. You know, you don't have to like sedate them or anything like that.
And just so everyone understands, like when you say chest tube, you're taking a tube, you're making an incision, you put it between the ribs to remove the air that got into the chest cavity that collapsed the lung.
Because essentially, you know, your lungs are very, they're kind of like sponges, right? So whenever you have that air kind of like circling around the chest and compressing the lungs, the only way to get it out is through a chest tube. A similar scenario can happen where blood fills the chest cavity and compresses the lung, but luckily that wasn't the case here. Yeah, I had him lay down and, you know, I'm sitting there like prepping the skin, making sure everything is sterile. You know, you get a lot of downtime when you're doing these procedures with the patient, so you get to sit there and talk to them, you know. And so I was like, I'm very curious, you know, this is an interesting story. So I was like, so what do you think is going to happen now? Like, where are you guys right now after this incident, you know? So I'm like sitting there anesthetizing him with lidocaine, and he basically told me, he's like, she shouldn't have stabbed me, but it was kind of my fault because I got, you know, insecure and I went through the phone and I couldn't find anything. And, you know, he's like, I think I still love her and I think I want to be with her. And, you know, you yeah, exactly.
Whoa.
So you also ask him, like, do you want to press, because we always ask for like any like alleged assaults, like, do you want to press charges with the police? Should we bring them here and have them talk to you? And he's like, no, I don't want to press any charges or anything like that. And yeah, it was a very interesting outlook.
He's like, no, I don't want to press any charges because I've got the engagement ring right in my pocket.
Hey, when you put that deposit down, you know, it's hard to turn back.
Yeah. Well, you know, the expression love is blind. I mean, there's no more proof than that story you just shared.
Exactly. So we ended up, you know, putting the pigtail catheter in. We drained all the air out. The lung like re-expanded. And I think we admitted him for like a few days just to kind of monitor and observe him for a little bit. I think he ended up going home back to his girlfriend.
You reminded me of a story that I have, which is also boyfriend-girlfriend. And I don't know if you see like a preponderance of boyfriend-girlfriend situations coming to the ER. Is that a pattern when you think about it?
It's random, but yes. Yeah.
You do see sort of more of that relationship-related stuff?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so when I was in residency in St. Louis, I was at St. Louis University Eye Institute, and we were covering the hospital and the trauma center downtown, which is, you know, major level, I forgot, like level 4 trauma center or 5 or 6 or 10, whatever the maximum number is. That was the level, right? So I get a call. I'm a first year resident, by the way. So we were always the first ones to get called to go down to the emergency room. So there's a foreign body in this girl's eye. I come down to the emergency room and I sort of like open up the drapes and I see this woman. She's like late teenager, early 20s, and she's just laying on the gurney and there is a blow dart sticking out of her head.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so her boyfriend, for fun, had bought a blow dart and was at home and surprised her and said, "Hey, babe." And she turns around and he just goes and just like shot it. He didn't mean to do it, but it's going to have a happy ending. So if anybody's getting really grossed out, don't worry. This will have a very happy ending, I assure you. So in any case, it goes, it flies across the room. It just nails her eye, literally nails her eye, because the dart goes in through the white part of the eye called the sclera, penetrates miraculously, missing her crystalline internal lens, goes out through the back of the eye, but it's pinned against her nasal bone. So like she's looking around and the eye is just like stuck out because it's literally been nailed to her skull. And it was literally the luckiest thing because her vision was still 20/20. And I called my senior resident. We took her into surgery and we very carefully removed the blow dart and sutured up the entry point in the sclera, the white part of the eye, and the exit point. And she postoperatively remained 20/20 with no infection, no trauma that caused any problems. And it was just so lucky because when the dart went in and went through her retina, it went through the retina that's like the most strongly attached to the eye. So it's like nearly impossible to get a retina detachment if something penetrates in this zone. And that was like the zone that like went in and it exited through a zone pretty close to that, but never got a retina detachment. So it was the luckiest penetrating eye injury that I have ever seen.
Question. So for when you're suturing the eye, are you using like tiny absorbable sutures or?
Yeah, we use Vicryl.
Oh, Vicryl. Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. It's small Vicryl. Yeah. So it'll absorb.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. There's so many like times in the ER where, you know, accidental injuries, even GSWs or gunshot wounds. We call them GSWs in the ER just for short, where the bullet literally just barely misses, you know, the aorta and like lands, you know, in the spine, but in a way where it doesn't cause like any like, you know, injury to the actual spine itself. And these patients like escape so like luckily.
Yeah, sometimes people just get super lucky like that, right? Totally luck of the draw that nothing super serious is injured with an injury. What are some other stories that come to mind when you think about the tall tales that your children's children will tell about you in the ER?
I had a very, very interesting case. And this was actually like last month. It was one of my first cases as an attending too, by the way. So I had this lady who came in. She was, I think she was 62 years old, like early 60s, right? So she came in for kind of like left upper quadrant abdominal pain, right? And she's been having like intermittent fevers and like all this other stuff. And she had like, you know, a history of like diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol, etc. And like a remote history of cancer, which since resolved. So she came in and she was very tender in like that left upper quadrant. And, you know, in the setting of like fevers and all this, we essentially did a CAT scan of the abdomen, right? So as a protocol, right, for in the ER, anytime we order a CAT scan, you know, we're like radiating somebody, right? So we always get a pregnancy test. It's almost like a reflex order. So you don't actually like order the pregnancy test, but it just comes like attached to like the CAT scan. So it's always done in anybody, right? Any female. But typically, like, you know, nobody really does them for anybody over, say, the age of like 50, right? Because the chances of pregnancy is very low. So for some reason, I guess there was a new tech working, and he did the urine pregnancy test because he just saw like a urine sample. He's like, yeah, I'll just dip it in there, you know, and test for pregnancy. And it comes back positive. So I was like, she's 61 years old. 61. I was like, that is very odd. Okay. So then they're like, do you want to go ahead with the CAT scan? I was like, no, hold on. Let me go back and talk to her for a second, you know? So I go back and I was like, hey, your pregnancy test came back positive. And she starts laughing immediately. You know, she's like, she thought I was like a crazy person. And I agree with her. I was like, I had no idea what was going on. I'm like, why is your pregnancy test, you know, positive? So she's like, not only, you know, am I 61, but I also haven't had sex in 5 years. So there is absolutely no way that there is any, you know, fertilization going on. So I was like, you know what? Sometimes, like, you know, it's very rare, but you may get like a false positive on these like urine pregnancy tests. So I was like, you know what? Let's do this. Let's get a serum pregnancy test. So we can actually use the blood to check kind of like for the same markers that you would find in a urine pregnancy test to check for pregnancy. And in fact, it's actually, pregnancy can be detected about 2 weeks earlier with a blood test versus a urine pregnancy test. So yeah. So if you ever get like, you know, sometimes it's too early on the urine, but the blood will pick it up. So I ordered the serum pregnancy test and, you know, I was like, you know, I didn't think much of it. I was like, that's going to be negative. It was probably just like a false positive, whatever. So I checked, labs come back and boom, there it is. Positive pregnancy test in the blood.
Wow.
So I'm like,
was her name Mary?
You know, I came back And she had like such a good sense
and
of humor. Yeah, exactly. So I was like, it's a miracle, you know. And she's and we, we're right. both like, you know, we're both like laughing and stuff. So I'm like,
so you got baby Jesus inside you, man.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, look, I understand the serum's pregnancy is positive. I'm like, you know, we can not do the CAT scan, but, you know, I think it warrants to kind of like investigate what's going on here. And she's like, look, there's no way I'm pregnant. I haven't had sex. I don't care what the lab says. I want the CAT scan. I was like, fair enough. So we get the CAT scan. And the cool thing about a CAT scan of like the abdomen that we do, it actually picks up the lung as well. It picks up like the base of the lung. And we get the results back, and unfortunately, she has this mass that's located on the base of the lung, right? The abdomen was clean, everything else was fine, except she had this like mass there. So I was like thinking, I'm like, you know what? In medical school, I remember learning that some tumors do produce beta HCG, which is, you know, the marker that we used in check for pregnancy. So the good thing about this was like it was more of a tumor. It wasn't like metastatic. You know, I couldn't find anything in the liver or any other parts of the lungs or in the brain or anything like that. So it looked like it was just still kind of localized to that base of the lung. And that is where her pain was coming from, which is why she was having these like painful, like left upper quadrant of the abdomen kind of pain, because that tumor was sitting at the base of the lung, which of course sits at the top of the abdomen.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And every time she would take a deep breath, it was causing that pain there. So we kind of sat down and we said, hey, like, you know, we can't like, you know, definitively say, you know, this is what's going on, because, you know, to appropriately diagnose this, you need to biopsy it and, you know, do a lot of tests and stuff like that. But I'm saying, you know, I told her, I was like, you know, likely, you know, in the setting of a positive pregnancy test, both in the serum and the urine, and with this, you know, new mass in the lung, that this is likely a beta HCG producing tumor.
That was a head scratcher.
Yeah.
Especially she's like, I assure you.
Exactly.
Like there's cobwebs down there. I assure you.
And she was like in good spirit about it. So she, you know, it's good to like, you know, we diagnosed it, you know, and, you know, gave her like appropriate follow-up and things like that. So it worked out.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome talking with you. And, you know, everybody, we have so much more to talk about that we're going to come back next week with Dr. Fayez, and we're going to discuss more stories, including this one that proves that the statement about an apple a day isn't always correct. An apple a day doesn't always keep the doctor away. You're going to find out why we say that when you come back next week. And remember, in the meantime, do get the book Influenced on Amazon or anywhere you buy books. And of course, you can get the link in the show notes directly to get the book as well. So do check it out, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Brian Boxer Walkler's Health Show. To review the show notes for this episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, and any links mentioned, visit nocaphealthshow.com. Don't miss another episode and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, make sure to follow Dr. Brian on TikTok at Brian Boxer Walkler MD. And remember, Dr. Brian is a real doctor, but he is not your doctor. He is here to provide general information, not medical advice. So you should always check with your doctor before relying on any information.